We are in the business of people. Every facet of our game is people oriented, yet we don't do anything to develop people. Bosses worry about policies, leaders worry about people, and people drive policies. And all the pressure cops are under, 1981. And the only thing we've done different in 40 plus years is we've just done a checkbox as to resiliency now that, oh yeah, every department needs a resiliency officer. I'm saying to survive the career with a sense of longevity, that you don't crawl across the finish line, that you sprint across it and feel a sense of vitality and accomplishment, you gotta know what you stand for.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. Along with my co-host, Stacey Raymond, I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with police commander, author, trainer, and professor Tom Rizzo about leadership and resiliency. Check out our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., and Responder TV. We're on bbsradio.com, Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio, and all the podcast platforms. And our website is respondertv.com. We'll be right back to speak with Tom after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW, EMTB.
And today we're blessed to be joined by Tom Rizzo. As the dust settled from the September 11th attacks in 2001, Tom began his law enforcement career as a patrolman with the Middlesex Borough Police Department in New Jersey. And then in 2004, he was hired by the Howell Township Police Department, also in New Jersey, where he's currently serving as the Investigations Division Commander at the rank of Captain. Tom established a set of principles based in self-discipline to achieve the best version of himself so he could positively impact others. And Tom's been both a police academy and department instructor and adjunct professor. And in 2019, he started Walk the Talk Consultants, where he currently instructs courses he built titled Ivory Tower, Operation Lead, and Trust in Teams, which have been presented nationally in over 40 states. In 2021, Tom published his first book, Kapikaze, based on a series of lessons to help navigate a career in a field of law enforcement, which reached number one on the Amazon bestsellers list. Congratulations on that. I know that's not easy to do. Yeah. Welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure, at least to virtually meet you guys.
So if you could just give us a little bit of background on your experience of rising through the ranks, and what were some of the lessons that you learned as a leader that you are trying to pay forward?
So it's ironic. I never envisioned myself going for promotions. I was right out of the gate. I wanted to be involved in interdiction and proactive policing. Never envisioned myself wanting to go the supervisory or the administrative route. I was a, you know, I guess I would say I was a creature of my climate and my culture. I didn't like the leadership. And I don't say that in terms of that I thought I was better. I've never felt that way. I've always been an advocate, you know, I joined the military before I was in the police department, and I've always been an advocate of the right type of leadership. I'll follow into the gates of hell. So I just felt like I wasn't being led. And I wanted to, desperately wanted to be led. And I think a lot of us do. So I guess I reached that crossroad. Do I want to continue to perpetuate the problem, or do I want to be part of the solution and take control of my own destiny? Like anything else, and this is where I'm openly critical, in a first responder game, and I call it a game for a reason, everything is negotiable. So there's just ways to understand a system and then to go ahead and negotiate it. And nepotism exists. It's ripe. But I always felt like if you put yourself in the best position, you know, that standard deviation, you can almost allow yourself room to be promoted. So from early on, I had the mentality, I just wanted to lead other people like I wanted to be led. So it doesn't mean that I'm some type of presumptuous person. I live by the golden rule. I'm not religious, but I'm faithful. And I treat people like I'd want to be treated. I've made a ton of mistakes, though. So I think what sets me apart is I embrace my vulnerability. I admit openly my mistakes, my trials, my tribulations, all the same. But I firmly believe, and I also did something that was unique, and I embraced hypocrisy. I am all the time doing things and saying things that somebody could point and say, hey, Tom, you didn't do that, or you would have said blah. And I say, exactly. And that's why I'm telling you what I'm telling you right now. So I don't say I do it better. I do say that I do it uniquely. But I caution folks who reach out to me all the time and ask me for some guidance about ascending through the ranks. And I say, be careful of the ladder of success. We all want to rise up the ladder. But the problem I have with the ladder is that one person can go at a time and you lose all cognizance as to where you came from. I prefer the spiral staircase, and that's the way I've tried to live my life and my career in terms of you can still get from the bottom to the top, albeit not as fast as a ladder, but you keep in touch with your former version of yourself, and you get to look out for the people that are ascending that staircase as well, because you're forced to constantly come back around as a 360 and do a reflection. So that's the way I like to do it.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
And it's so great to hear that, you know, you've made a concerted effort to stay in touch with where you came from, because it's an often repeated criticism that people that rise through the ranks lose touch of, you know, who they were when they first started out in this profession.
That's a fact. That's a fact. And I don't think that we'd be experiencing so much of the strife and the anxiety and the attrition that we're experiencing now if we would cure that one facet, just that one facet. And I say this openly, it doesn't, you know, entail an increased budget. It doesn't entail fancy equipment. It entails empathy. That's it. It's free. It's free.
Yeah. I'd love to move that thought into this about your book, Kapikaze, The Crucible to Manage Mission Impossible. One of the reviews that I was reading said, I wish I read this going through a police academy. So with that in mind, what gaps in law enforcement training and education does your book address?
Exactly what you just called it, training and education. I think that they're vastly two different things. And I'm so tired of seeing report after report, analysis after analysis that always go back to the same thing, inadequate training. I'm an advocate of training dogs. I think we should be developing people. And that's where I see the huge gap. We are in the business of people. Every facet of our game is people oriented, yet we don't do anything to develop people. We focus on the memorization and the regurgitation of policies, directives, and procedures, and then the practical application of those procedures, and not focus on the human element. Listen, I say again with humility, I hold department records in terms of arrests, seizures of narcotics, drug, cash, weapons, you name it. I am telling you, there is no good way to do it in terms of without people's skills. Why wouldn't you want it to go smooth? Why wouldn't you want people to tell you where their hides are? Why wouldn't you want people to handcuff themselves? Here's why, because you don't take it personally. You take it serious. There's a difference. But we don't do that from the academy stage. So we come out with robotic clones of policy and procedure, but no way to practically apply it to people. And that's why we fail.
Today, we're joined by Daniel Sundahl. He's a published artist and writer and has three art books produced of his works. Articles of Daniel's work are featured in several international publications, and his art is recognized worldwide as he travels internationally speaking about his art and personal experiences with occupational stress injuries and post-traumatic growth. He's an advanced care paramedic, pre-hospital educator, a retired firefighter, photographer, and photo editor. Daniel, warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
So what do you think, Tom, gets in the way of the empathy factor that you're saying is so important? What gets in the way of that?
I think there's three prongs. I think ego, first and foremost. I formally believe that I can't believe it's not already classified as a disability. Working for narcissists, I can't believe that people legit aren't on disability for having narcissism, because that's the only way I can make sense of a narcissist, that it must be a disability that they can't understand, because it's toxic. The vitriol and the invective of what they do in the leadership ranks has ruined police departments. That, in addition to, I believe that political interference will ultimately go down as the venom as to what's done. There's no way to be empathetic to a culture of cops or first responders in general from an administrative climate when you have political climate that does everything else but. And last but not least, that I do not believe at all that, you know, I don't practice this, but I think that ultimately leaders that ascend in certain type of ranks and abilities, they believe that empathy is almost like a weakness or is almost like a vulnerability. Because in order to be empathetic, you have to be open to your vulnerabilities as to where you've been hurt. So I say all the time, I open up my lectures and I say, who better to talk about addiction than a recovering addict? I say, well, I'm a recovering jerk. So I say, and I know exactly what I've done to hurt people, to sever relationships and to screw up. And that is why I'm being empathetic to what you guys and girls are experiencing. Simple.
What would you say to someone who's just leaving the academy, entering the job as a rookie? What kind of advice do you give in terms of navigating the path, which can be treacherous in police work with the trials and tribulation in today's world? Some of that may be leadership. Some of that might be politics or the public.
Sure. I'm consistent on this one, and I've gotten stones thrown at me for it, and I don't mind. I say openly, honestly, candidly, that you work for yourself. You work with an agency. And why I say that is because no matter, you can never, ever, ever, never predict what's going to happen to the culture of an agency. It takes one election. It takes one promotion. It takes one incident of national stature to change the culture of an agency. So if you don't establish the foundation of what you yourself stand upon, you are then subject to the chameleon effect to the culture. Sometimes that can work out positively, but all too often it works out negatively. And you ultimately end up becoming your environment. So in order to sustain and in order to survive, and I don't mean a tour, I want every cop and first responder to go home safe. That's not my point. I'm saying to survive the career with a sense of longevity, that you don't crawl across the finish line, that you sprint across it and feel a sense of vitality and accomplishment. You got to know what you stand for. Forget a mission statement. Have your own personal mission statement. And then you can adapt it to the organization that you are employed by.
So you're sort of suggesting, you know, have integrity yourself as an officer. And
I don't even mean the integrity clause. I'm saying your sense of principles. So, and this is where I'm open and candid. If your principles are skewed to what we would agree on, right? Let's say you have no ethics, no integrity. Well, okay, just at least understand that that's what you stand for and expect bad things to happen to you. When you try to fit a person like that into a culture that stands for integrity and blah, 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 it doesn't. It's Jekyll Hyde. So that's why I say, if you don't know who you are and what you stand for and establish that sense of value, you have no idea what agency is going to be a good fit for you. And that's where I try to counsel people. I say, be careful. I know agency A is offering you $10,000 more a year, but it does not fit who you are, your prototype. You will fail.
Okay. I have a question about the ivory tower that we've heard David mention. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So I was fortunate up here in the Northeast. We're gifted and I'm so critical because we're so blessed in the first responder game that they gift us from the military sciences, the best of the best. So up here in the Northeast, we have a command and leadership program sponsored by the West Point Military Academy. And what they do is they give us PL-300 as a military junior level semester course at West Point. And they give it to police and first responders as a command structure. I was very fortunate. I got to go attend the class as a student. And they allowed me back. I was respectfully insubordinate to the curriculum, and they were crazy enough to invite me back to instruct. So I kept taking that, and the foundation of that is transformational leadership. So I said, I love the theory and the idea of transformational leadership, but in practical application, we go back to our hallways and it doesn't get applied. So I'm, as you can tell, I don't believe in just being a squeaky wheel. I want to be part of the wheel of progress. So I built my own course, and I said, I can see what the problem is here. In the ivory tower, I'm not being critical of administrations and inciting a revolt of administrations, which some people think. No, I'm saying as we ascend, we mean well and we want to do well. It's just the problem is when you're up there in the tower, per se, the line level and the connection is lost. And that is what's plaguing us. You could even take a terrible policy, a restrictive directive, whatever the case may be. If the connection was there, we'd be better. I stole, you know, an excerpt out of a book by Brené Brown. I'm a huge fan of hers. Yeah. And she cited this, and I went, oh, my God, it applies to policing. There's in the Air Force Leadership Manual in 1948, there's 147 references to humanness and connection from leadership to subordinate levels. In the modern day manual, there's zero. And I said, this is policing. I just recently posted an advertisement. It has a police officer with a wheel gun like this from 1981. And it says alcoholism, divorce, suicide, and all the pressure cops are under. 1981. And the only thing we've done different in 40 plus years is we've just done a checkbox as to resiliency now that, oh, yeah, every department needs a resiliency officer. That's great. What does that mean? What does that mean?
All right.
And I call it for what it is. I'm part of the problem. I'm in administration. I'm still active. So, again, I think this separation, if we could connect some of the pieces, we're game. So Ivory Tower teaches to keep yourself connected and to have leadership as a perspective. It's not a rank. It's not, and I'm not a hippie. I'm not saying that you can make organizational change as a line level officer. In reality, we all know that you can't. But if you can, if you have the right leadership perspective, it can guide you accordingly.
So, you know, what I have observed, and I don't know if this is worse in the Northeast than it is like out in West, but could it be that leadership has gotten so far away from its constituents because of like fear of having the town sued or the department sued? Do you think that that plays a role in sort of getting away from the humanness and the connectedness between leadership and the officers?
I wish it was about liability, but I think that it's more plausible deniability. And I focus, part of my class is I talk about the four walls compared to the four corners. If we focused more about the four walls of our agency and what's going on within those four walls, it would have a reciprocity effect to our constituents. I see it all too often, and I'm a poster child of it. I tell the story openly and honestly. My wife had already had my son, my oldest, so she knew what it was to have a baby. She's pregnant with our second child, and I'm on my way to a training class. Training is sanctioned by the department, counts as your day of work. So what happened was I'm on my way, and I get the phone call. Something's wrong. So short of the long, a friend of mine called me. I missed his call that he was helping me out at home. I'm so worried about work. Oh, my goodness. I'm not going to the training class. I don't want you to think I'm AWOL. To make a long story short, I end up coming home. So I missed the intercept call. Don't go home. Instead, go to the doctor. Short of the long, she lost the baby at the house. Okay. When I go back to work, my boss doesn't even nothing. No check in. No nothing. No, hey, how are you? No nothing. But had the wherewithal to dock me the attendance. Right. So now I say to you, would it shock anybody? And I'm embarrassed and regretful to admit this to you. I had back to back to back demeanor complaints, excessive force. You know, why? Because you just treated me like the lowest of the low inside my building. But then you expect me to connect with the public who might be struggling that day. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. Hurt people hurt people. So it's easy. It's Stacey. It's easy. It's so easy. But we're so obsessed about connecting with constituents. Administration's now in the hot spots, and I've been to every one of them. Name one, I've been there. They are worried about connecting, not even with constituents, with agitators that aren't even part of their communities. I wish they would worry about connecting with their constituents. Mm-hmm. And you know what they would find out? Their constituents do support them. Their constituents want one thing, dignity when being dealt with. Sure. Simple. Right. I just got back from Minneapolis. I walked the streets in the hot spots. Overwhelmingly, I encountered people who said, yeah, we're cool with the police. Yeah, we need the police here. Why? What did you think? I'm like, well, what I thought is what I see on television, right? They go, yeah, there's some bad cops, of course. But they go, yeah, we want them here. Yeah, clean up that over there. Yeah, clean up that over there. Yeah, no, when we having a problem, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so you don't want the ice cream giveaways? They went, no. Did you ask us? No, we're good. We don't think that we want the TikTok dance-offs either.
When you retire, you're just another employee. It's gone. In 10 years, you'll be, oh, yeah, that's good old what's-his-name.
And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost three decades.
There's a running joke that says that as you retire, you're forgotten about before you even leave the parking lot.
It wasn't that I was losing the passion for the job. I decided I want to go ahead and transition and start traveling and talking to groups of people.
I lost who I was. I didn't have any plans for the future. I sunk.
And we're always saving for a rainy day. And what ends up happening is you die and you never receive the benefit of you working so hard for so long.
It's as if you've lost a loved one. For me, there's a sadness there.
They really do become your second family.
I was a firefighter. That was always what I wanted to do. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you find yourself without an identity.
I would pass police cars and it was like somebody punched me in the stomach. Like I got sick because I missed it so bad.
When you say I'm a retired firefighter, people, they notice. And they're like, wow, man, that's incredible. And it provides an avenue for you to be impactful.
What are the ingredients of a good leader? What's the difference between a leader and a boss?
People. Bosses worry about policies. Leaders worry about people. And people drive policies. Mm-hmm. And I've said it openly, you know, trust, vulnerability, I think are the cornerstones. I think that when a leader can turn around and have their ego aside and want the game to continue to be played and hopefully played better than when it was when they inherited it, I think is I can identify a leader from jump. Adaptability, flexibility, perspective, and attitude. Mm-hmm. And I say that all the time. But instead, what do we always run into? The ones that no way, no how, I have the patch, the pin, the rank, or the ribbon. So that makes me right. And yes, I'm biased and I'm sore because even – and here I am 22 years later and gray and I still get the kind of like, who do I think I am? Because I'm young in terms of perspective. That what the industry would recommend. And it's not about a lack of respect for my elders or the ones that came before me, but we run into this problem that, my God, there are some insecure folks out there, and they hold on to that rank and they hold on to those ribbons in a way that shields them from any type of vulnerability. And that's a shame. They're doing the opposite. They're actually crushing their legacy compared to building upon it.
Well, Tom, we've talked about this kind of in a roundabout way in almost every question we've fielded here, and that's choice. What choices we make coming out of the academy, what kind of, you know, perspective we're going to have about the job and how we're going to be in that job or how we're going to be as a leader when we reach that rank. What do we need to know about the power of choice and the results of being in the state of choice rather than being a victim to circumstances?
Man, it's almost like you spied on me. I do a whole block on, you know, doesn't matter how large the class is. I start with somebody in the right corner room and I end in the left corner. And I say, here's something right now, right here that we all have in common. We all have a free will. So I say, the next time somebody ever reaches out to you and says, hey, I'm in a jam, I'm in a spot, I'm getting victimized some which way. Mm-hmm. I always say, what part of the scenario or the equation did you contribute to? And the reason why I know this all too well is because I spent the first several years of my career in a state of depression because I felt like I was being victimized when I was clearly making choices that I thought were that's what real police work looks like. He doesn't know what he's talking about. She doesn't know what she's talking about. And my God, I built a house of victimization and how I'm a victim to this skewed system and how I'm a victim of to this inept leader and I'm a victim to this and I'm a victim to that. When I was making the choices to feed myself my own demise. So I say, anytime somebody comes to me for help, I'll give you the shirt right now off my back. No problem. But I always say, I can't help you until you identify with your part. I didn't say blame. I didn't say blame. Mm-hmm. But your contribution to the situation that you're in. Let's talk about it.
You know, that perspective also gives the officer a sense of control, right? Because even though they don't want to admit that they've contributed to their problem, if they can get there, then they know that they can now change. They can make the decision to change, behave differently, say things differently. And then that empowers them, you know, to be a better officer.
And you hit the nail on the head. And we are control freaks. I mean, that's what we are as a prototype, right? So, and I embrace that. And I know it took me a long time to admit it. And but I say all the time, so I jump on that as well. And I say, and here's the beauty of it. And we're always about winning. We're so hyper-competitive. And I say, so then don't let them win twice. Well, what do you mean? I said, well, if you feel like you've been mistreated, there's your, you know, they won on that one because they can technically, right? But now in your reaction, you can't control other people's actions, but you could always control your reaction to their actions. So if you react in a poor sense, they're going to win twice. And a good friend told me this, you know, you can make people, you know, very happy and reassured when they didn't choose you for something, or you can make them regret it and wish they had. That's up to you how you react to it.
Yeah, great perspective. And, you know, I think that you may have mentioned this, or at least I read it, something you wrote about it, and that's responders having a shelf life. And how do we make the most of the time we got so we can make a difference, set ourselves up for success if our next chapter is, you know, moving on from law enforcement into something else related or unrelated? How do we do that?
So again, in my vulnerability, and I talk about this openly, I'm now unfortunately estranged, you know, from my wife of almost 20 years. And I say it, I said, listen, you have to build the house from the inside out. I said, don't worry about the curtilage. Don't worry about the landscape. Don't worry about the car in the driveway. And I mismanaged a lot of those things. Good intention. But I mismanaged it. I worried about acronyms. I worried about accolades because with the thought in mind, the end goal in mind of this will build my future accordingly my loved ones. But what do? We turn the mute button onto what the loved ones are actually asking for. So as much as it hurts me and it pains me and you know, no matter what my individual future may hold in terms of my own relationships, I feel like, again, I could keep that in my secret pocket and only discuss that with my course of therapy. Or I could use it as a catharsis to help myself by helping other folks not walk that walk. So I always say about the shelf life, you could still be relevant. I mean, look, you're retired and you're still having an impact. I don't say this is shelf life in terms of your tenure. I say a shelf life in terms of prioritization.
Tom, was there a turning point for you? Was there you know, a seminal moment where you kind of woke up and decided I need to do things differently, or things can be done differently, and I want to pursue that?
Yes. And the point that it got to me was it was almost like an epiphany moment where I said, you know, I have more than your average Joe. I've done more than your average, you know, Jill. And I said, and I'm still not happy. I said, you know, and it's so embarrassing and so ugly to admit those things. You know, when you're around people that don't have a fraction of what you have and haven't experienced a fraction of the blessings that you have. And here you are still, woe is me. So I know this sounds cliche and corny. I just got tired of being tired. And I could tell you, I absolutely embraced the fact that I had some depression issues. I had two of my very closest friends at 14 commit suicide. And then I had a work colleague that committed suicide by a cop by his own department. And I acknowledged, you know, that I had those similar depressive type tendencies, but that I was contributing a lot to it. And I was allowing, like I said, you know, that's why I say I'm the biggest hypocrite out there, because I was doing what I tell people now just don't do. And I just know, because I know the pain. I know how it hurts. And so for me, I would love to tell you the Knight in Shining Armor story that, oh, yeah, my kids and this and that. And that it wasn't even enough. I knew I had to do it for myself, because if I don't do it for myself, I'm still going to, you know, be worthless for the people that I proclaim to love so much.
I don't know if you coined this term or borrowed it, but yeah. I love it. It's called multidimensional wellness. What does that mean exactly?
So, you know, it's all of it, right? I believe firmly in certain things are interrelated, and you fake it till you feel it. People are scared to say something like that because they think you're being fraudulent or you're being an imposter. And I say, I'm trying to show this to you. Again, there's a lot of people out there to talk about this, you know. You're grateful. I said, go to your grateful, and that will lead to physical health, mental health, overall wellness. And for me, I believe it so much. I literally wear it on my neck, and because the body can't be physiologically stressed and grateful at the same time. It doesn't fix your problems. Fix your problems. But I say, what is all this for if we don't do multidimensional? And again, I use myself as an example. So if you get all the acronyms at the end of your name, if you get the salary that you desired, if you get the certificate, are you happy though? What happens when that's over with? Mm-hmm. Well, you have a single dimension. So I say, why not kind of balance these things out so that all of it's in line? Your physical health, your mental health, your relationship health, you know, your aspiration health. So I do this whole block where I lay it out. And I use all the senses, the sight, the hearing, the taste, the touch, the smell. And I say it should all be interrelated. And I think that if we do the multidimensional, and it's, this is so easy to indoctrinate in an agency. It costs nothing. It costs nothing. And you talk about the return on investment. You won't have people running for the doors. And the people who do stay will be giving you 110%. Do you know why? They'll be at 110%. You know, that's what we're experiencing right now.
Check it.
Can you define, you know, what is the difference between transformational behavior and transactional behavior with regard to law enforcement?
Sure. Similar to the question you asked before, boss versus leader. Transactional is something, but here we go again, right? Everybody's worried about identification tagging. So I say it's okay. Transactional, you need them. I am that. We are all that innately. Processing, directing, it's the making of widgets. We all have that. It's okay. But I always say, how about you be transformational during the transaction? How can you do that? So simple. Hey, this is the way I'm going to show you how to put together this widget. I don't know, in your background, you have another way of doing it? It may not be my way, but let's rock. Go ahead, let's give it a shot. What could we do? You could do that with anything. You could do that with anything. And I said it from the custodian to the CEO, you could always be transformational in your encounters. So transformational leads to the wellness. Transactional leads to the task orient. Does that make sense?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, the humanity is taken out if it's a transaction, really.
Yeah, so I say all the time, you know, the transactional is you know, just the directing of the person or the procedure, and the transformational is the feeling behind it, the emotion behind it. But emotion can drive behavior when it's fostered in the right atmosphere.
Yeah, that's a great distinction to make. And I know we're moving rapidly from question to question here, but there's so much amazing stuff we want to cover. Okay. So we're just trying to get to all of it.
No, it's cool. I'm game.
Great. You you touched on this also. Let's circle back to it. Work-life balance. It's a struggle for a lot law enforcement and probably everybody else, fire, EMS, to come up with a balanced life, which between the job and the home life and outside of the job. What can we do, people that are in the responder profession can do to kind of right that tilt in the balance?
So I'll give you an easy one to start with organizationally and professionally. What we could do, our agencies could start to adopt. We're so, like I said before, what do we focus on? And we always, you know, overcompensate for training. I say, how about a socialization phase for the loved ones of the officers that you hire? And they all look at me like I'm crazy. I say, imagine for a moment, if you were to call in the loved ones of these people that you just swore in, they held the hand on the Bible, everybody takes the pictures. Everybody at that night is clapping and can't wait. That's because they haven't yet experienced the missed holiday, the missed birthday. I'm stuck at work. I'm still thinking about work. I'm jammed up at work. I got yelled at work. I had somebody screw me at work. Here we go, right? So I say, how about we give a socialization to who? To the people our stakeholders are going back to. Right. And I mean, that's what would help us. That would be indelible to the survivability of the game. Now, on the personal side with the work-life balance is I almost think that we should incentivize at work. See, we obsess, if you're anything like me anyhow, I mean, I would physically be home, but mentally I would still be at work. And I don't mean that in the sake of trauma. That's what we love to do. I say it all the time. I say, no, I'm still thinking about that case. I'm still thinking about we want to go get that son of a gun that did X, Y, Z, and we want to arrest him and we want to bring them to justice to face, you know, the consequence for their behavior, right? And you obsess about these things, you know, and then what are you doing? You're sitting there texting who? Oh, I'm going to text the fellas. Hey, I can't wait to, you know, look at this, look at that. And it doesn't ever turn off. And that's what I was accused of, but my mute button was on. Hey, right. Tom, you're here, but we could tell you're actually there.
Yeah.
So I would almost incentivize like we do when somebody gets a certificate or somebody gets, you know, a graduate degree. I would incentivize if you showed me, hey, you're a youth baseball coach. I love it. Hey, you belong to XYZ community group and you do that with your family. I love it. Hey, organize these things and incentivize them to bring back to work credit. And I think it would bring the balance together. It would show that you're dedicating so much of your time, your energy, and your spirit to an organization who's recognizing the sacrifice that you're making away from those same people.
I can certainly relate to, you know, getting drawn into all the things besides the job and thinking about the job, but also the activities the union would have and other opportunities to show up for extra training. Where it can become basically your main focus, right? And to the exclusion of home life, family life, loved ones. And so easy to do.
Well, let me ask both of you then about, like, do you think that, you know, because David being a retired firefighter and Tom being an active police officer, do you think it's because the job is just more adrenaline and it lights you up a little bit in a different way more than kind of the home life? Do you think that that is, you know, why, you know, the mute button goes on, when an officer comes home, as you said, Tom?
I think, well, this is unpopular in some circles, but no, I believe because we call it a selfless service. And I say it couldn't be further than the truth. It's a selfish service. And hear me before you guys attack me on that. I didn't ask anybody's input about, hey, I want to go do 600 search warrants. I want to go chase down, you know, the worst of the worst. I didn't ask anybody's permission to that. That's just what suited my DNA and as to what I wanted to do. So adrenaline's the wrong answer. It's just the fact of, hey, this is, I think there is absolutely a personality. And I'm never ignorant to say all. But the majority that are in the field have a certain thing where I don't think it's very vastly different than a gang mentality. We seek that identification and that same type of mindset in a group setting and that fraternization and that solidarity that it becomes addictive in that term.
Sure,
and then we don't feel the same and we don't feel that same connection at home as far as, hey, why are you being critical? Why are you being, they have my back, where it's like your loved ones have your back tenfold more. tenfold more. Because guess what? You don't ever expire from. You don't expire from being a son, a sister, a wife, a mother, a brother, a husband.
Right.
That's who you were before you got into the game. And that's who you're going to be when you get out of the game.
Right.
And that's the mistake. That's the mistake. I mean, I definitely made that mistake as a husband. I started to make that mistake as a father, and I can tell you right now, I mean, there's salvation, at least in my role as a father, that I know I've repaired it, and I will never go back to that. And I'm still – the beauty of it is I found a way to still give 100%. You know what my 100% is now different, though? I don't focus on me being always at 100%. I say, you know what's pretty cool, too? If I could take 100 people and effectuate them in a positive way, 1%. Now I just have a movement. Now that's a movement. You know why? I didn't just focus on me at 100% because I'll get exhausted and burnt out.
Yeah. Well, I can piggyback on what Tom said, that there is a, I was going to say seductive, but also the word addictive component to being part of that tribe and part of that, you know, the mission of being in law enforcement, fire, whatever it is you do, that it was almost like a rush, right? Sitting home with the family, getting a text from a group text from the guys on the shift.
Right.
You know, busting each other's chops, talking about the next road trip we're going to take. And somehow my concentration, my focus went to that and not being present with my family. You know, I think the job in general has that seductive nature to make kind of pull your focus and attention away from the mundane, you know, so to speak, the everyday events in life, which really are foundational and critical for our well-being once we leave the job. But we forget that. We forget that we got to come home to, you know, do we want to come home to a house with loving family or come home to an empty house when we hit that finish line? So great points, Tom. I really appreciate you sharing that.
Well, again, and I say, right, this is free. We could do this mentorship post-academy. We could show as we ascend. Like for me, I know what it's like to have screaming kids. I know what it's like to have laundry. I know what it's like to have dishes in the sink. Like, and the show goes on. Not because I'm old and wise. Well, I already experienced it compared to a 22-year-old, right? So that's why I say what I say. But again, so what if you were to take – we always find time. So if I told an organization, okay, you got to do 10 minutes of fire extinguisher training, they would find the time to do it. If I said you have to find 10 minutes to sit there and explain the new license plates that were out there, you would find the time to do it. Why don't you take 10 minutes where every shift you have in your muster, you have somebody mandated that they got to talk about something going on with their family in a positive way or if they're struggling even. Mm. Again, this is how we create that connection, right? This is how we create that connection.
Right.
And I openly say, I knew for me, you asked before, Stacey, about another moment where it was an eye-opener. Mm-hmm. Well, for me, and not because I'm John Wayne, but for me, I knew it was a problem when I would go like this. Oh, cool. Hey, this guy Dave just ran that way with a pistol and he threw drugs out of a car. I would say, all right. But then if this thing were to ring and the contact were to say home, then I would say, oh, what now? Oh, my God. What is going on? What is it, the cable? What is it, the hot water again? And it's like, wait a minute. That's what's setting me off. But to go through the unknown and be like, man, I just drove up the wrong side of a highway and almost got killed, and I'm high-fiving saying that was great? Come on. Something's out of balance. Something's out of whack. But what are we doing? Dave will back me on this. We say, oh, hell yeah. That guy, he's great. He's a stud. Look at him. Where somebody should have been saying, hey, stupid, you got your wires twisted, bro.
Yeah.
Man, great, great points, Tom. And I think we've covered an amazing amount of ground. You've contributed an incredible amount of information, insight, perspective, and your, you know, your skills and wisdom on all this stuff. So as we wrap up, any other things we didn't cover you want to speak about?
You know, I just, first off, I say again, with grace and feeling so thankful to you guys in terms of please, please, please continue what you're doing. You know, be openly critical. Don't be afraid. Color outside of the lines because we need you. You know, Dave, and God bless you that you made it through your career. And I'm saying, and my hat is tipped to you that you're still, like I said, making a positive impact because I'm telling you what we've done. What we've done is checkbox now. Yeah, so it looks great on paper. There's resiliency programs and there's a mandate to have resiliency officers and the like. We're still sitting there and repeating the same things over and over and expecting a different result. There's departments right now that are offering up to $75,000 sign-on bonuses, and they still can't get people to sign up. Why? Because they – and it's not a recruitment crisis. I say this openly. We have a retention crisis, and it is because we are cannibals – to the human side of what we were before we got the job. And now more than ever, people are seeing it. They're not saying it's not worth it because of the money. They're not saying it's not worth it because the job is not salacious and exciting anymore. They're saying it's not worth it because it's legit. You're signing up to feed yourself poison. And if we don't do something soon, we're not going to have to worry about what the problems are in the industry because there won't be an industry to sit there and analyze much more. And forget us. We've already walked our walks in life, okay? For the next generation, what in the hell are we leaving for them? So I pray. I am not saying I'm some type of messiah, but I just pray that more and more people like us network, and at least if you make an impact on one person, well, guess what? That's more than somebody else has done. So I say my hat is off to you. Thank you guys so much. I'm not going anywhere. That's why, like I said, I'm very blessed to be able to get out there and to get to different areas and people and meet people that I would have never had the opportunity to meet prior to. So that's where I'm at, and that's where I'm going to continue.
Fantastic. Well, all good stuff, and thank you for being part of this conversation. Where can people find you out there, internet, social media, and please also share where they can find your book?
Yeah, sure. So my website's probably the easiest. It's www.thomasrizzo.com. Not too difficult. That has a list of every course that gets scheduled for me and where I'll be. Has ways to sign up. It has means to go ahead and purchase the book if you'd like. It's available on Audible. That was a fun one. That was a tongue twister. I was fortunate to get into a studio. They wanted me to narrate it myself, and I got definitely tongue fatigue doing that. Yeah, like I said, that was a bucket list dream of mine. So now I just try to mentor people and to help them on their trajectory if they want to follow, and do something of the like. But, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Very easy to find. It's at TomRizzo70 on Instagram. And I constantly am posting videos and sharing content. I'm a huge advocate. I'd be happy to share your information as well as, again, I'm a fan of everything that you guys are doing, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I really very much so owe it to you, and thank you, and I very much appreciate it.
Well, and the feeling is mutual, and I did want to comment that a lot of your video content, at least the ones I've seen, are short form, which is, I think, in today's day and age, something most people, it'll fit into their bandwidth easily to watch something that's, not 20 minutes, but just a couple of 2-3 minutes. So that's a great thing. Also, kudos for the Audible version of your, the audiobook version of your book, because for those who don't like to read or don't have the time to read, there's no excuse. You can listen to it, any place, anytime. So
that's right.
Well, Tom, great stuff. Such a pleasure to speak with you and to hear all about your mission and your work. And please continue success. Stay out there and keep doing what you're doing to support the brothers and the sisters.
Yes, sir.
And I just wanted to comment. I really enjoy your passion and your enthusiasm.
No, thank you, Stacey. I appreciate it.
Please like and subscribe our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV. We're on all the podcast platforms and bbsradio.com. And go to our website for past episodes and guest information, respondertv.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.